Session number 20599, Reel 1.
Mr. Witchwell, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Darlington, County Durham.
Which year was this?
1920.
You were telling me earlier off the record that your family was long established in County Durham.
I don't think I quite told you that. The family came from Kendal in Westmorland and were very long established there. In about 1859, my grandfather, William Whittle, was sent from Kendal, together with his younger brother Thomas, to work in the works of, or under, though I think he died quite soon after that, Robert Stevenson, George Stevenson's son, to learn engineering and the management thereof. And they set up a works at Thornaby-on-Tees, which made pig iron, and that was Whittle and Company. And it operated for about 60-something years. It came to an end in practice, it stopped trading, I think, in 1925. Originally, it was the source of such money as we had, I suppose. But I may need to explain, though I don't want to widen this too complicatedly, that we were related to the Pease family, P-E-A-S-E, who were virtually the founders of Middlesbrough, and Joseph Pease was the first Quaker Member of Parliament in the Reform Parliament of 1832. And it was as sort of cadet relations of the Pease family that the Whittles were in, to some extent, on the whole of this coal and iron business in Teesside.
Were you a Quaker yourself?
No. In practice, the attendance at meeting and all that kind of thing had stopped comparatively early on. My eldest aunt, I think, occasionally went to meeting, but this seems to have been, to a great extent, mixed up in, quite happily, the branches of the Church of England, if I can so call them, that were a pretty low church. The Church of England, as we know, is pretty widespread. And indeed, I think by my father's adulthood, it's extraordinary how, although the attendance at worship, whatever denominational thing they belong to, was still very much the right thing to do, I'm not sure that anybody really believed in anything very much, except the importance of good manners and generally being, ideally, a sort of English gentleman.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at Stowe, which was then a fairly new school. But for background, the family school was Uppingham. And I was not sent there because it was considered a slightly rough place. And in one way, I was a delicate child in that I had polio as a small boy, And the headmaster of our prep school, which was in the South, incidentally, was very much in contact with the headmaster of Stowe, and thought that I would probably be happier there, and I was indeed very happy.
How old were you when you left there?
Left Stowe?
Yes.
18, I suppose. Which was the beginning of 1939.
What happened to you then?
What happened to me then? I spent the much of the rest of that year, at least the sort of middle part of that year, in France, informally learning French. And I then went up to Christ Church, Oxford, at the beginning of the war.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did indeed.
What reaction did you have to that?
Such was the build-up to this that I don't believe that any person who took any interest in anything can have been in the least surprised at the outbreak of the Second World War. I remember I was still at school when Hitler made his 1938 speech, and which was followed by the Munich conferences and so on. Everyone knew this was coming. The intellectual young were already divided to some extent, but chiefly they were supporters. They were anti-Nazi. You will remember, at least you won't remember personally, but there was a sort of a prelude, a rehearsal of this in the Spanish Civil War. And one was very, very well aware, as an intelligent schoolboy, of all these things.
Had you been involved in politics yourself?
No. Except that I was aware of the elections and so on. It so happened that the constituency of Darlington was an enormously interesting one. And the history of that and the odd changes between liberal and conservative were very noticeable. And indeed there was a wild man who became MP for Darlington in, I think, something like 1910, when there were two elections, the thing over the Irish question and all sorts of stuff went on, who was an extraordinary Hungarian Jew who was eventually imprisoned as a traitor in the war and ended up died, I think, in 1940 as the self-proclaimed head of his own Buddhist sect in China. So that was, you might think that Darlington was rather staid and boring place, but politically it was not without interest.
But you hadn't joined any organization yourself?
No, indeed. I mean, as a public school boy in England, one didn't, but I did have one friend who did his best to be an active communist. That was the way that most of the intelligent young were going at the time, as a protest against increasingly Nazi tendencies. Remember, it wasn't only Mussolini's fascists were an earlier, were the first of these sort of official gangs, if you like, and were copied all over Europe. Each country really had its something shirts at that time.
Do you remember the name of this friend who tried to be an active communist?
Yes, His father was a, he was of Finnish origin. He was called Lars Ulrich Borenius, and his father, who was a great man in the art world, was an advisor on art matters, if you like, to Queen Mary.
And had you? Had you met him at Stowe?
Yes. I mean, he wasn't even a very great friend, but he was just about a contemporary of mine at Stowe. And he was on the conference. We also had, there was someone, I think he was that much older, I never really knew him, who was killed in the Spanish Civil War on the communist side, if you like to call it that, the Republican side as opposed to the Franco side.
Who was he?
I've forgotten his name.
Was he a poet?
Now, there was someone who was who was a poet, wasn't there? But I don't think he was a
Well, it doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah, Keyes. No, that was somebody else. But that was the background. I mean, and of course only. A year or two older were the Cambridge lot who became the Russian spies.
What did you read at Oxford?
History. But of course I was only up at Oxford for four terms.
At which college?
Christchurch.
What was Oxford like at the beginning of the war?
There was still a good deal of food and drink about. It varied a great deal from college to college, and Christchurch was rather over-organized because the steward, who was a man called Hill, had, I think, been engaged in rationing and things actually during or only just after the First World War. And he rather enjoyed this kind of thing. And I remember when I went up in 39, we were immediately issued with little books of sort of coloured coupons to buy food, well, food and drink and things with in college. He enjoyed this sort of thing, if you see what I mean.
Was the education affected at all by the outbreak of war?
I should think enormously, because a number of the Dons went into various kinds of military service. One of the most distinguished of those being Frank Pakenham, who became Lord Longford.
What happened to you when you finished your four terms at Christchurch?
Well, you see, what happened first, if you like, was that we all expected to be called up in the spring of 19, or at least my generation, spring of 1940, but that got postponed because of the losses at Dunkirk. And so that was when I first knew this part of the world, because I went for a few weeks and worked in the land of a man called Rolf Gardner, who lived down near here, and who one of my friends knew, a sort of war work, weeding and helping with his estate. We had been expecting to go into the army, but we had to wait.
So you're talking about Wiltshire.
Well, that was my first introduction to this part of the world, because this man Rolf Gardner, who one of my contemporaries knew, I forget which, who was the friend, and said, "Well, come and do some land work on the Springhead Estate, which was at Fontmell Magna, which is just between here and Blandford.
What was the next thing for you?
The next thing for me was to get into the army. That was a splendid fudge, but the universities already had officers looking out for possible recruits of the, for the, if you like, the grander regiments, the Brigade of Guards or the Green Jackets or something like that. And one of them got to know me, or I got to know him, and he said, well, why don't you go and see the Lieutenant Colonel, who's the person in charge of the regiment, up in London, and subject to medicals and things, and subject to his interview, which is the most important thing, we think we'd like to get hold of you. Well, I may have seemed an unlikely candidate, having, as I said, suffered from polio, but in those days it was enormously important to get into uniform, and I rather imagined myself perhaps immediately being found out as being medically unfit, and getting some sort of minor staff job. If you got into uniform, they paid you for one thing, so that there were advantages in this, and so I got into the army, rather to my own surprise. And went on from there. In spite of my then fairly slight lameness, because I'd been, although I had polio as a small child, and I was most marvelously looked after by an osteopath in London who also had full medical qualifications, and except for slight lameness and unhandiness at one thing and another, I really managed very well.
So we're talking about the end of 1940, are we?
Yes. Well, I mean, all these sort of medical things were yes. That's right. We're talking about the end of 1940, and I actually went to the shortened wartime Sandhurst course at the beginning of 41.
What was the Sandhurst course like?
Well, it was all sorts of things. I mean, it's rather hard to describe if you wouldn't know it. I mean, it was a shortened course of general military training. To go back for a moment, most public schools had what were then firmly called OTCs, which stood for Officer Training Corps. That became elitist, and they're now called something slightly different, but in fact, I and another great friend of mine who doesn't really otherwise come into the story never joined it, partly because my housemaster was something of a pacifist, and partly because my family thought that because of my polio lameness, and they weren't the only people, there was no chance of my being required for military service ever. But such was the general feeling in the war that we all ought to be doing our bit, and so did everyone, and so was everybody else, that these things were largely fudged. And so through I went.
Did you find the course of much benefit to you?
Well, it was a necessary step in sometimes people had to go through a course as slightly bogus private soldiers. It was known, there was what was known as the brigade squad, and it was they kept on changing these things because people were wanted more quickly, or they thought of new methods of training and things, and it so happened that I got on rather a short one between the beginning of 41, and we passed out, as the word was, in May, I think. And I went to the Guards Training Battalion at Pirbright.
Can you describe what happened to you at Pirbright, please?
Well, ordinary training as a second lieutenant, a very junior officer. One was alternately in charge of things and ordered about on the barrack square as if one had been a private soldier. It was all sort of a part of the thing. And various exercises on that military part of Surrey, Chobham Ridges and all those kind of things. They're always supposed to be a would-be army officer or otherwise military man could more or less see the whole thing in one. the initial training at Sandhurst. Then there were the sort of training battalion where you learnt to be a platoon commander, and of course within sight of all this, and it's the same piece of country which was more or less unusable between the time of the ancient Britons and that of the Duke of Wellington, there was of course Broadmoor, so that there it all was, if you like. And after that, you got posted to another battalion, which was either of your regiment, or there was what was called the holding battalion in London, which did public duties like the Tower and Buckingham Palace and that kind of thing. But that involved a good deal of formal parading, even of a minor kind. And the fact that I was slightly lame as a result of this polio, though it was barely noticeable, meant that I spoilt the pattern of big drill parades. So I never went to that, and I went I think at the beginning of the war, the Coldstream, which I went into, had three battalions. There was then a fourth battalion which was essentially mechanized and became part of the Guards Armored Division. And there were two other infantry battalions, the fifth and sixth. And I went into the sixth, and we did our ordinary sort of training in the area north of London and round about kind of North Holt Aerodrome and that sort of part of the world, Pinner, Harrow, various places, living in billets from houses that had been evacuated, occasionally going off on some kind of exercising a bit with the Home Guard, or all sorts of stuff like that. Nominally, one's work was support of the civil power. And a kind of watching out if there was all sorts of scares of German invasions and one thing and another. Goodness knows there was plenty to do. And after, what was it? I suppose about a year of that. I was posted to the 2nd Battalion in what I call the muddy end of North Africa. They just had a considerable battle at Medjez El Bab, more or less on Christmas 1942. And I joined them after that, and there was a breakthrough by the Germans when Well, it was nearly the joining up of the Eighth Army and the newly formed, which we joined, so-called First Army, which was originally a little more than a brigade, which was in Tunisia. And then, so before very long, we were we took part in and witnessed the German surrender in Tunisia, which was the beginning of May 43.
We've rather shot ahead there. Can we go back to your voyage out to North Africa, please? Any memories of that?
Only that the ship we went on from Liverpool, which was called the Samaria, which of course had become a troop ship, it was a sort of minor Cunada, I suppose, or something, it happened to have been the only liner I'd ever seen when my mother took me to look at some big ship at Liverpool when I originally went down was taken down to consult a well-known paediatrician called Sir Robert Jones soon after I had polio in 1926. But that, of course, had been turned into a troop ship, and after hanging about in Liverpool Harbour for a bit, and we were no doubt escorted, and I don't know much about this, we went out a bit into the Atlantic and then in again through the Straits of Gibraltar. And landed in the neighbourhood of Algiers, and pottered up to the line by various stages, fairly easy ones, in ancient trains, with those wagons that said in French either 40 men or 8 horses. Those were for the men, and the officers had ancient railway carriages. And I joined the 2nd Battalion. We had a little battle almost at once when quite a lot of the company transport was knocked out by the German 88 guns, which were. Sort of self-propelled guns, rather feared, and a certain amount of Stuka dive bombing and that kind of thing. But after that, there was an almost complete gap in North Africa between May and 43. And the beginning of February 44, nothing happened at all. We were, you know, why are we waiting, we called out. There were various, some of the my colleagues went to guard Churchill somewhere. I think he, after the Casablanca conference, I think he was convalescing somewhere, and somebody went a company or something went to look after him. We also occupied one of the Italian islands briefly called Lampedusa, where there were about 4,000 Italian prisoners, and there, I think there were 2 Germans looking after a wireless station. Of course, we went there in a fairly slow sort of way by ship, and the Germans were able to blow up the wireless station, and we then just had to wait on the island until we'd shipped all the Italians off to a prison camp. And after that, we just sat about in the sunshine and the olive trees and everything else and waited until we were called upon. Why are we waiting, we asked in the sort of way. And some of the really rather senior commanders, at whom we used to laugh quite a lot, said, we are waiting for the armored breakthrough in Italy. And I and various other tiresome subaltern officers said, armoured breakthrough in Italy. Have you ever looked at a map? There would be clearly no such thing. But you know, that sort of thing. But we rather enjoyed ourselves. We kicked about. There were various little exercises. There was some there were some Canadians up near Constantine in Algeria, the Royal Vendus, the 22nd, and they had some kind of hospital there. We had quite a lot of liaison with the French, who were in rather an uncertain position. Some of them had been more or less supporters of the Vichy regime. There were a few Americans.